capability actually is to get us ready for the future rather than keep looking at the past. And it's a muscle. It's a muscle that you have to train yourself in like an athlete. It's a muscle you have to build at the most atomic level and at a universal level.
Typically, counterintuitively, we find that innovation happens when systems are rigorously implemented. Talent trait is described as, or defined as, knowledge plus practice plus competence in execution. And these three cannot happen without sufficient training happening.
Judgment. Because you need to take decisions on the spot. The difference is, you know, doing that analysis, preventing the breakdown from happening, and not losing productivity.
Right.
High performance will show up when errors are prevented from happening.
Just about anyone, anyone who's led a team or has had to work with people or depend on people to get something done has probably asked and answered this question for themselves. And therefore, it's a very, very common question. If I am in a soup, what or who would I depend on? That genius, you know, superstar who may or may not show up when I really need them the most? Or am I better off actually depending on a set of processes and systems that have been built to pretty much take care of a situation like the, you know, tricky one that I find myself in? Well, there's no choice there at all. And I know what you're going to pick because I know what I'm going to pick. But I'll tell you one thing. I'm happy that you picked the Steel of India podcast to get your insights on the way the steel industry is evolving and indeed embracing future readiness. And that's a phrase you're going to hear a lot of on this particular episode. In this episode, we call it, by the way, Metal of India. We're going to explore leadership behaviors, talent pipelines, and capability. We're in fact going to try and work out what it takes to build the real hero of the story. And that is high performance culture that is backed by processes, systems, and certainly capability. And to help us in this conversation, because there are different facets that will come into play, we've got Gautam Malhotra, who is CEO at Jindal Steel, joining us. And he's going to help us understand what it really means when you say capability. What's it going to protect us against? And what is it going to enable in business terms? Now, Gautam has 2 decades of experience across areas, strategy, operations, mergers and acquisitions, digital transformation, and more. And he's also walked with traditional industries on their journeys of innovation and organizational agility. But before, you know, we get to that aspect of the business end of things, we need to understand that capability is also a function of culture. It is, in fact, culture, right? So if we want to understand how to break it down into its constituent parts or behaviors, then we need to hit the shop floor. And that's where we are hoping Rachita Sehgal can take us to on the conversation today. She is Vice President of Learning and Organizational Development at Jindal Steel. And we'll see how capability plays out at the very basic ground level. But we also want to be understanding the topic through the wider lens of future readiness. And of that, we also mean industry readiness. And that's where Ravi Taneti can help us. And he is Managing Director of NETUR Technical Training Foundation. Ravi will help us decode what that industry readiness is all about and how we can get there at scale. He brings with him over 30 years of experience in areas like strategic leadership, capacity and capability building, technology enablement, collaboration within industries, and also partnerships with bodies like CII, FICCI, external, you know, central ministries, and of course, state government. So we have quite a lineup of speakers today to enrich us with their wisdom and insights. Thank you all for being here on the Steel of India podcast.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to start with you, Gautam. You've often said that capability, you see it as a function of something that lives and breathes and is real on the shop floor, right? Now, I want to take that it's not just there in reports. So you mean for it to be actually something that's tangible. When you come to the Jindal Steel context of things, I want to anchor that idea in what we do. What is it really protecting us from, and what is capability enabling us in business terms?
See, I think you use the word protecting, and I think of it as projecting. You talked about future ready. I'm talking about future forward. So capability actually is to get us ready for the future rather than keep looking at the past. And it's a muscle. It's a muscle that you have to train yourself in like an athlete. It's a muscle you have to build at the most atomic level and at a universal level. Atomic level would be at an individual level. Universal level would be at a systemic level. So that's where your learning, skills, training come in, and where your systems and processes come in, and they marry each other. So what capability does is it helps you navigate the choppy waters, the black swan events like COVID-19, 2008 crisis better. It protects you from chaos and instability, kind of provides you a sense of calm and confidence.
I want to come to, you know, terminology. We very often in the context of manufacturing, especially, we talk about, being industry ready on day one. Help us understand, Ravi, what that really means from your vantage position.
Typically, what happens is when you're making a person industry ready, the bulk of the focus is on his technical skills. But more often than not, it's not the technical skills, but the surrounding ecosystem that we build around him.
Yeah.
So there are four aspects to a talented operator or a talented technician to actually realize his potential on the shop floor. These four, I would not in any particular order, but would be behavioral, the ability to work long shifts, the ability to do monotonous work, with a high level of quality, being able to work with a view of the production line rather than his own station, right? So it's a lot of teamwork that he needs to work with.
Right.
The second is he should be a champion of systems because the more rigor that he brings into the systems, the more alignment he brings into the systems. Typically, counterintuitively, we find that innovation happens when systems are rigorously implemented, right? That is the second one. The third and fourth would be a part of the training systems that need to be put in. For example, critical thinking is one of them, where the operator consistently thinks beyond his work or beyond his description, job description, to see what innovations can happen in the system. So that requires an application of mind and knowledge.
Yeah.
And the fourth is, of course, where the manufacturing is moving. Today, we're talking about smart manufacturing, which means the shop floor has become smart. So you would require data analytics, you would require total productive maintenance, right? You would require, IoT. So the operator needs to be able to straddle those technologies. So all these combined with technical skills would make him future ready.
Yeah. So a combination of all that you said plus the technical skills is what really makes you future ready. Rachita, you've seen some of this play out under your very nose, right? Quite literally. So, what else would you add there? Something from the Jindal Steel context of things.
So I think judgment, because you need to take decisions on the spot. It's your technical backing supports it, but it's not sufficient. So I'll give you an example from Jindal. We have been doing this program on skilling our employees. And as part of that skilling, we've given them training on 5S and TPM and safety. And what we found in one of our plants is that a particular team, after they went through this training, paid greater attention to the sound, unusual sounds coming from a particular motor. And when they checked further, they found that the temperature of the bearings was very high.
Right.
There were unusual vibrations. And before it led to machine breakdown, they decided to track trends, do analysis, and also plan for maintenance, which was tagged to a planned shutdown. In the past, It would have led to a machine breakdown. But this time, they decided to address the maintenance during a plant shutdown, ordered all the spare parts, understood what needed to be done, and did it during the plant shutdown.
Right.
So the difference is, you know, doing that analysis, preventing the breakdown from happening, and not losing productivity.
Right.
Coming on that, I have, you know, something Ravi, you said was beyond the technical skills. And Rachada, you mentioned it. So we're talking a lot about 5S, TPM, etc. And I was actually trained very early on by very great Japanese leaders. And it was all about situational awareness as well.
Yes.
You know, when you're sitting, you see the glass and you see someone waving the hand, oh, the glass is about to fall. You should be aware. It's about the decision making. You talked about judgment. Okay, this could go wrong. What decision do I have to take?
From what each of you has said, it is very clear that this is not a function of heroic acts of, you know, flashes in the pan, sudden, you know, save the day kind of knight in shining armor. This is more, as you rightly put it, about someone who's a champion of the system. That's where it all begins. And yet, Gautam, you would have seen in your experience across organizations also that organizations tend to rely very easily on these superstars. What sets an organization apart, the one that relies on superstars, apart from one that relies on systems?
So a small organization, as it's growing up, can rely on superstars or heroes, so to say, or a hero to lead them through the early journey. But as you become part of a larger organization, or you've grown into a larger organization, at that point, to manage the complexity, you need systems and processes to come in. Because the risk you carry with heroes is if the hero is not there, then the whole thing collapses. Whereas if systems and processes were there, it doesn't matter whether Gautam's on the shop floor or at a managerial position or it's Rachita or Ravi. The process will guide the whole thing through. So that's what you're protecting in a systemic organization. And again, I'll take an example. I'm a cricket lover. I play competitive cricket. So you remember 1990s, before it's pre-Ganguly era, and Tendulkar was peaking and coming into the legend that he became. And it used to be that Tendulkar's got an out, switch on the TV, India's going to lose the match. And that's the hero thing. And look at the team that won the World Cup. There was no hero. There were many heroes, but there was not one hero. It was a system. It was a winning mindset that came in and won the game. So I think that's the difference.
It's not about heroes. That much is established. But it certainly probably boils down to leadership, right? You have to foster this thinking, nurture capability. And you have to also, as a leader, as a CEO of an organization, you have to do it across the rank and file, across plans, sites, shifts, cycles. All of this needs to be consistent. So what are those leadership behaviors that will make high performance an inevitability?
First of all, a leader has to have vision. I think about a minute or two back, we spoke about, you know, situational awareness. And a leader needs to have the foresight because things are continuously changing. Your macroeconomic environment, geopolitics, everything has an effect. So there has to be a vision, there has to be a foresight on where we are headed and why we are headed in that direction. Beyond that, a leader must have a strategy to achieve the vision.
Right.
And I fundamentally believe there are three pillars of strategy. One, there is no strategy without numbers. Two, there is no strategy without execution. And three, strategy is not static, it's dynamic. It's an ever-evolving world. The competitive landscape is also changing. The market's also changing. So you have to be nimble, flexible to adapt. Once you've got that in place, you need to have a great organization design, which actually aligns with the strategy. And by organization design, I don't mean organization structures. There has to be role clarity. Everybody needs to know what their role is. You can see it. I mean, even in sports, you can see it. Everybody knows what their role is and they play it to that role only. I mean, you don't see Bumrah opening the batting first. That's it. So once you've done that, then you come to the organization behavior. And that's where cultures and everything starts setting in. Beyond that, what a leader, I think, needs to do is have very strong review mechanisms. We should not rely on escalations. That's management by exception. There should be a strong review mechanism along with strong feedback loops. And a great coaching ability to be able to coach the next set of leaders. And then press repeat.
Mm. You make it sound really very easy. Sure, it's easier said than done. But Rachita, I'm going to come to you because all of what he's describing, what Gautam has said to us, sounds like culture to me. And again, capability is that one thing that shows up in how a handover happens when a ship changes. It's a function of something you've hardwired as culture in the organization.
Sure.
So what has changed in terms of handover discipline and shift in discipline? And give us some sort of insight into that.
Sure. So in the past, shift changes were, I would say, more casual. Yeah. The people handing over to the next shift would just share verbally, what needs to be done. And that was usually the way it went.
Okay.
By putting systems in place, what we found is that, and I'll give you an example. So there was this particular team that again noticed an issue with one of the machines, but their shift was going to get over. So they flagged this off with the next team. And the next team took that further and inspected that machine further. And they were able to identify what went wrong with it. This wouldn't have happened if we did not have a written handover culture that was a system put in place.
Yeah.
So it is a shift in culture, you know, from conversations to written to visual as well. So we've got these visual boards that that have the entire data up there with responsibilities of who's in charge of what. And you can see when you move from one shift to another, you can actually see visually what's going on. Right. So you don't have to reinvent and re-look at everything from the start. So that has really helped in increasing productivity, in preventing breakdowns, and a lot more clarity because people know who needs to do what, when, and how.
Yeah.
We can actually build on it. So a traditional view would be a LOTO, right? A lockout, tagout system. But if you see, back in the day, actually, what we did in one of the factories was shift gets over at 6 p.m., let's say. So we said 5:30 to 6:30 is going to be prime time. Mm-hmm. It's back in the day, you know, you used to have that Doordarshan 8 o'clock, mm-hmm. that nice sound would come and news comes on prime time TV, right? So we used to call it prime time. 5:30 to 6:30 is prime time. And that is when we used to measure productivity and have an added incentive for that 1 hour. Mm-hmm. So shift going out and shift coming in actually was like a relay race handover,
right.
And we actually saw productivity shoot up. So you can gamify it and make it even more interesting.
This is fascinating. Ravi, I'm waiting to hear from you because what the two of them have said completely speaks to your experiences, seeing as you're at the intersection of industry and institution. You have unique insights.
I think both the points are extremely powerful. I mean, it's the power of visualization, you know, because at that levels, it may not be possible to communicate on a daily basis. And what you have is the visual effects of the directions. And what Gautam said in terms of being able to gamify, you know, and, you know, kind of make the systems more enjoyable, right? I think, and a bit with an incentive to of recognition or whatever kind of incentives.
Right.
I think both are very powerful thoughts. But what I also believe is that, if the operators can be also, I mean, in what we work with very junior, the 10th pass kind of guys who get into the shop floor for the first time. But what I find is that their ability to absorb the cues that are available in the shop floor, the way the team works, the way the supervisor deals with them, right? The recognition or the energy that comes into when they innovate something. I think these are some of the things that we need to bring them up on the shop floor so that everyone feels a part of the overall production machine that we run, right? And I think that's where industry and academic actually can work together. to bring some of those convergences to the shop floor.
I'll come back to that question. I have more to ask you in this partnership. But, you know, there are two different ideas that I have sort of, I don't know, they've stuck in my head. The situational awareness, which to my ear sounds like there is a foundational readiness built into someone who's about to enter the system. And then you spoke about a champion of systems, which is something that is homegrown in many ways, right? It happens once you're in the system, then you understand what this is about and you... What, Gautam, is more valuable for an organization? This capability that is homegrown and internal, or can this foundational external readiness give this thing a bigger lift, push?
One thing that I think we need to build on is marrying an ability to a requirement. And we don't do that enough. Mm. When we start talking at the layer where Ravi was talking about at the shop floor level, most people are there to earn a livelihood. They're not even worried about what skill they have and is it married to the job or not. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times we're missing that thing. Mm-hmm. Are we marrying the right skill to the right job? Mm-hmm. And it's our duty to do that. Yeah. And that's where a lot of, you know, understanding, and you can do it through testing or other interesting methods to understand the skill to the job fit. And sometimes... work on the skilling itself.
Right.
Apart from that, I think there's a lot of work that can be done in the external environment to make people industry ready or job ready. And that's something we all can invest a lot more in.
Right. And you directly sort of led me to in the direction of Ravi. I can just blindly go to Ravi with my next set of questions that come in. You know, he's answered a bit of that for us over here in terms of what is the problem when you say, you know, there's a talent shortage, because now we are we've entered the realm of talent and skilling, that ecosystem, as he rightly pointed out. And you sit at that intersection, again, what he said is required, industry and institutional partnership. So when an organization, Ravi, comes to you and says, oh, there is a talent shortage, I'm not able to meet, some of it is what he's spoken about, the marriage between abilities thing is not happening. What else? What do we really mean? What are we failing to do at scale?
I think one of the valid points that Gautam has mentioned is understanding the role first, right? If you understand, I mean, the requirement cannot be that I need talent. Talent for what? Talent is never in isolation.
Right.
It has to be aligned to a role. And the general principles that we follow is that a role is fixed, right? But that's not the case. I mean, like, as the business performance changes, as the ecosystem changes, as the external world changes, the roles get their own hues, their own colors, their own contours, right? So the role is not a passive, a kind of dovetailing of talent to, you know, a role. It's not that way.
Yeah.
So when a role is evolving, the talent also has to evolve, which is why I believe that a continuous learning is an integral part of shop floor maintenance. The operator, the technician has to be consistently trained in line with the role that he's doing. For a moment, even if the role is not changing as quickly as we would expect it to change, a consistent refreshment of his knowledge, of his skills, that translates to excellence. So, for example, talent is described as or is defined as knowledge plus practice plus competence in execution. And these three cannot happen without sufficient training happening. And that can happen externally or internally. It'll be easier to do it externally because the faculty is there, the infrastructure is there, right? And that's not a core capital requirement of the industry. So it's possible to hide that off to the external world, to the academics. Yeah. But I think that is the way forward.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Since you brought up training and the need for formal education, there's a lot of chatter about a likely misalignment between what formal education has to offer and what a high-performance organization really needs. Mm-hmm. Ravi, tell us about the gap between formal education and training that we offer to people and or rather the misalignment between that and expectations of an organization that's on a high performance trajectory.
So like I was saying, the formal education, there's a lot of focus on concepts and theory, right? And not on the practical knowledge of it. So we discuss the, we are taught the what and the whys, but not the hows. Even the infrastructure that is available in this, in many of the institutions reflects that prioritization. For example, the equipment that is available in the institutions, it's all for touch and feel. It's not for do and learn, right? So the students, they know how it looks, they know what it does, they know why it does, but they don't know how it does, all right? So when they come from that kind of background, when they're transported or airdropped into the shop floor, many times they struggle with learning, you know, learning the whole thing all over. So that is part A. Part B is that the success stories that come out of engineering colleges are not related to who became a good engineer, but who has gone into management, the IIMs or the bureaucracy or the IASs, right? And because the success stories say that, you know, he's done an engineering and has gone to in the management, but we don't listen to too many success stories about how an engineer has become an excellent, you know, electronic component manufacturing engineer in, say, an Apple or a Tata Electronics, right? We don't listen to those success stories. So the role modeling is in terms of going away from the engineering, right? And because the talent goes away, the capital also follows that. So the companies spend more money in paying the management graduates and the bureaucrats than paying an engineer. So the funds that should get allocated to the R&D, R&D shops and the design centers, that funds don't come there, right? So that's the second problem that happens. And the third and equally, again, paradoxical problem is the actual hands-on work is done in the ITIs and the polytechnics, but they're not as they're non-aspirational jobs, right? Nobody thinks about, I mean, they are the last resort of the failed candidates, right? And the electricians, the fitters, the welders, and the data operators come from there, right? And they run the entire, you know, the underbelly of the shop floor. They said there's a space there for hands-on training. There is a space, but somehow we're missing that space and, you know, going into the other kind of curriculum and other kind of formal education, which is not aligned to the industry. Yeah.
Well, there are two thoughts that come out of this. One is apprenticeship. And if you look at Germany, Germany became a manufacturing powerhouse, and they have a very well-developed apprenticeship system. And that's something we have been trying to work at Jindal Steel as well, the internship and the apprenticeship system, and build that into a way of life. And that's where the marriage between, you know, the universities, the academia, and the industry can happen. But there's one important aspect I picked up from one of your things. See, any young engineers watching this, they should go away with the message that, yes, there is a pool of people which have moved away from engineering, but engineering is a path to management. It is not a deviation. Management is not a deviation from engineering. You can exactly use this path to get to management. And we a lot of times talk about, you know, people coming up the capability ladder, and there's a fork who's going down the technical capability ladder and who's going up, rather, the management. And you have to distinguish. And it's only the 10 or 20% you distinguish and take them to the management capability ladder. The others go down or go up this ladder. And at that point, the eventual goal, you can actually get into research and development also. You can get into material sciences. You can achieve whatever kind of success you want. So the message that I think we should be talking about is it's a path to success, rather than success lies at a deviant to this path.
Absolutely.
So that's the way I look at it.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Superb. You know, and in terms of, you spoke about education, I want to come to that other thing, which is the second part of how you train people, how you assess people. So if you're getting things wrong when it comes to, you know, training them in the right fashion so that they're employable or industry ready on day one, what are you possibly doing wrong in the assessment? Clearly, there must be some gaps over there as well. So what does assessment that is aligned to business performance really look like, Ravi?
This is a very vital part of the organizational journey, right? We have these annual appraisal cycles and the normal curves, and, you know, 15% are not good enough. right? But somehow that, I think it has lived its life in my sense. Today it is about continuous assessment. If you're going to benchmark an individual on continuous learning, and if you're going to benchmark a role that is continuously transforming, why would you appraise him once in a year, right? Why would you not appraise him on a continuous assessment, right? There could be some incredible operators, right, who are much better at quality control than maybe operating the machine, because their attention to detail is far higher. And that gets demonstrated, you know, not once in a year. It gets demonstrated throughout the days, right? Every day. For example, I was at Tata Electronics. These girls, there are 17,600 components that go into a mobile, right? The miniaturization is so high. Yeah. And these girls, 15-year-old, 16-year-old girls, sitting in the assembly line, and the defect rate is 0.1%. Because the quality of detail is so high. Mm-hmm. Right, and they're doing almost 3,000 mobiles in a shift. Yeah. Right, so maybe there are operators and technicians there who are very good in quality control. There may be great design thinkers sitting there who are operating a machine. Right, so you have to do a continuous assessment of your talent, and find places for them to grow and contribute. So my sense is that the assessment should be not a periodic function of an HR priority, but I think it should be a shop floor activity driven by finding talent and there are many diamonds out there and where to find them.
And I think associated with that continuous assessment is the continuous learning as well. Because if you're identifying people with certain skills, then you need to help them hone those skills to be able to take on those roles that you're training them for. So that has to be continuously assessed. And I think the third thing that has to be continuously assessed is, what are we expecting that job role to do? Because what that does today might change, because, you know, we may introduce automation or whatever. So then what that person needs to do changes. And therefore that shift needs to be made in terms of how we're assessing them, how we're training them as well.
I'm quite certain then it's time to explore that intersection of worlds. There clearly is a handshake that is waiting to happen. It's happening. But, you know, sometimes, as we know, in the world of handshakes, one will be a very limp one, occasionally the fish one, whatever it's called. But we want a nice, solid handshake between institution and, industry. What does that perfect alignment look like to you? I'm going to start with you and then move it on to our other experts.
So I'm very happy to say that I can see it happening. There are three areas I believe the industry, academia can collaborate. The first is on the product lifecycle management, right? When you productize a particular thing, right? There is a concept, there is a design, there is a prototyping, you know, there is a manufacturing, and there is a go-to-market, right? So these are the five stages of productization. I believe that the industry cannot take all the five facets of it. It's very difficult because these are all, again, like I said, it's a non-core capital for them. Mm. Why would I invest in, a design team? Why would I invest in a prototyping team? Why would I do that? Because they don't come cheap. The machines that come for prototyping are not cheap. But many of the academic institutions have this already. Yeah. And the faculty is already working on those aspects of it. So the industry can easily hive off the concept, design, and prototyping to the academics. Of course, obviously with a severe oversight and budgets and timelines, because academics don't have any sense of these three things, right? You need to have oversight, you need to have academic rigor, but you also need to have timelines. So that part of it can be given to the academics. Yeah. And, you know, it'll be a phenomenal collaboration for the sum is much larger than the parts. The second collaboration, and this is something that I have not seen happening so far. The first one is happening. The centers of excellence coming up. Mercedes is doing it. And a lot of companies are doing this kind of, academic collaboration. What I'm not seeing is that many of the industries face problem statements. These are not statements of, these are not large overarching statements, problem statements. These are small individual statements. Which generally, you know, people would not focus much on. They would take it as a part of the overall journey and they just let it be. But some of these problem statements can actually be hived off to the academics, because the students out there are looking for industry projects. Right. Like you were mentioning about internships, right? Many of the students in engineering colleges are looking for internships to handle live projects. Mm-hmm. So why don't you give off these projects to them, right? And they can do it in, they can probably visit your company maybe once in 15 days. But they can come with a solution, and that can easily increase your productivity and your performance by at least a factor of, 0.5, 0.8, right? So that is the second one. And the third is, in terms of, like we discussed about the upskilling, the reskilling, right, and the deskilling, and, realignment to automation, etc. All these are being done by the faculty in various colleges. Right. So these are the three areas where collaboration can give immediate results to the industry.
At General Steel, we've partnered with a lot of skilling institutes in the areas in Orissa, where closer to our plants, where we send people, for certain periods of time to the skilling institute, where they have all the machinery, etc., that these guys need to practice on and make their mistakes on before they come back to the shop floor. So I think that is, like you said, beginning. It is work in progress.
Yeah.
And it just needs to be taken up a notch, because the newer machinery needs to be brought in for people to be able to work with and so on. And that's where I feel industry can help also.
Right. Yeah. So far, I mean, I think we've managed to cover leadership behaviors, systems. We've, thanks to you, got a look at the shop floor and what capability looks like there. We've spoken talent pipelining for manufacturing specifically. And by now, I think our viewers have a sense of what capability is. But I want to ask all of you, what does high performance really look like? How would you define that? A metric or two, if you get capability right. Let's start with you, Rachita.
So I think if high performance will show up when errors are prevented from happening.
Mm. Okay. All right.
So it's preventing errors rather than addressing errors.
Yeah. Ravi?
Capability is expressed when the system can take care of the situations.
Yeah.
And it doesn't require, people.
Heroes.
Yeah, heroes and black capes. Yeah.
All right.
You asked, what does high performance look like?
Yeah.
I'll draw from sports again. It looks like, and you have that relay race.
Yes.
The baton handing over.
Is passed on, yeah.
Looks like that marathon runner, when he goes into that zone, it looks like, even if you go to other streams, an orchestra in full unison. It probably looks like a ballet dancer, oblivious to the whole crowd in their own zone.
Yeah.
It looks like those two batsmen who just exchange a glance and take the run.
Yeah.
That's there.
Yeah.
And in an organization, I think all that comes together and looks like cross-functional symphony, what we technically call cross-functional teams working well.
Yeah.
That's what capability, and that's what high performance will look like.
Yeah, that was truly music to my ears, the way you actually brought it all together. It's time for a quick little rapid fire round. I've got questions for each one of you. Let's start with you, Gautam. What is the biggest myth that you've encountered to do with capability in manufacturing?
Jugaad works. When I keep talking about, it's a muscle you have to train and build daily. Jugaad works is a myth.
A small indicator, Rachita. The capability is actually improving, not just performance. One indicator.
So I'll say mistake-proofing with confidence. Unless you have the system in place, they cannot do it with confidence.
A leadership trait or a set of behaviors that you would like to promote with one eye on building capability at scale.
Learning. I fundamentally believe reading helps a lot. But for people who find reading difficult, I think YouTube videos are brilliant. I watch a lot of them.
Great. Nice recommendation. I'm going to come to you. One thing that skilling must assess for role readiness, but doesn't actually do very often.
Attitude. attitude is at different gates, right? Before they enter the shop floor, there's an attitude. Once they enter the shop floor, there's an attitude, right? Once they grow, there's an attitude. Once they don't grow, there's an attitude. You know, once they learn, there's an attitude. So, like you said, I mean, if you have to go up the ladder, you know, from entry level to maybe a plant head, right? It is your ability to manage change, to be ability to introspect and, you know, realign yourself to new learnings, right? Contributing, making others learn. Because success in shop floor is never individual, right? It's a system, as I said. So I think the attitude determines how well, you know, an individual does.
The other thing we can't measure is judgment also. Where are we assessing people's ability to take judgments? Yeah. When in that split second that they need to take it in.
Correct, correct. Talks back to what he said about situational awareness. But yeah, one question for you, Gautam. If you were to pick four long-term advantage, would it be stability or speed?
Stability. My personal experience, you can be high speed, but if you don't have the processes, capabilities, which are whatever these things that give you stability, right, very high chance of, you know, okay, tripping over.
Superb. And with that, it's a wrap to this conversation, but I think you'll agree with me if I were to sum it up this way. Big takeaway is that capability is like the operating system for performance. In fact, it holds together strategy across sites, across, you know, cycles, across ships, really. And we've also seen in today's conversation how it really shows up in leadership behaviors, how it really it translates to action on the shop floor, and how it's inspiring how we train talent before that talent walks onto a shop floor. So many thanks are owed to our speakers today, because they've infused, each of them, their own wisdom, their personal experiences into our understanding of capability, leadership and talent pipelines for not just the steel industry. I'm sure a lot of these lessons really apply across sectors, across industries. I hope you found this conversation valuable. I must thank Ravi, Gautam and Rachita for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And for our viewers, we'll be back with more episodes of the Steel of India podcast. Make sure you don't ever tune out.